to invite Paddy to come along, unless I've forgotten anything. No, I think it's time, ready for you to kick off when you are. If we're all sitting comfortably, then Paddy, please begin.
Right, thank you, Paul. Okay, well, to start with, back in November, I attended an all-day event by a New Scientist on the future of food production. And so I thought it was about time I passed on some of what I'd gleaned from all this techie optimism that I experienced all day. And I pinched a few of their illustrations as well. I'm going to have to leave out more than I put in, and I'll try not to run on too long, so there'll be lots of scope for discussion. So, first of all, can food tech feed the world? Let's just skip through some quick statistics to see the lie of the land. So, agriculture produces 20 to 30% of global emissions. Slide three we're going to be on now is a thing called the World Counts. This has got a lot of metrics that count our journey to doomsday in real time, as if you're not already depressed enough. And one of those is hunger statistics. So 25,000 hunger-related deaths per day, 9 million a year, which is a bit ironic when there are 819 million obese people. Picture four is a world hunger map. And if you notice, the darkest reds seem to be in some of the most productive places. The orange and reds are all in Africa. Madagascar's one of the worst, which is a bit funny because all our food contains palm oil grown in Madagascar. What's also not funny is that worldhunger.org says the planet produces enough food to feed everyone. The main problem is lack of money to pay for it, something we've been saying for donkey's years. Then there's the global habit of monocropping, which is a sort of evolutionary high wire act where one slip could be fatal. The entire world is fed off just 15 crops, and 60% of global calories are supplied from just six species. Globally, there are 417 edible species that are currently in use. This is out of, for example, the global banana crop is just one variant. But the total number of edible plant species known at the moment is 7,039. The next couple of slides are a couple of weird edible plants I've never heard of. The marama bean from South Africa and the akub, which is an edible vegetable in the Eastern Mediterranean that they stick in omelettes. Well, if they're not growing all these exotic things, what is the world growing? Well, can anybody guess what the world's biggest crop is? That's rhetorical. I'm going to tell you, it's sugar. Here's the 10 top crops by tonnage from the FAO statistic for 2013. And it runs like this: sugar, corn, rice, vegetables, rice, sugar, wheat, sugar. If that was updated now, soya would probably be in there. So production is centralised, it's concentrated, and it's uniform. And so we have factory livestock farming, concentrated, intensive, and that's producing new diseases. Here's a cutesy little, picture seven is a cutesy little mink behind bars to tug your heartstrings. Isn't that cute? Denmark's just culled 17 million of them because of a new variant of coronavirus. I could talk a lot about intensive animal farming, but I'm not going to, except that it is definitely a big disease vector. Okay, so moving on to picture eight, what is the new food tech? And here again, I'm going to have to skip through it quickly. Well, some time ago, I talked about the fourth industrial revolution, the digital revolution. So you won't be surprised to learn that a similar thing is going on with digital agriculture. Part of this is digitising traditional farming, in other words, doing what's always been done, but doing it better and cheaper and more efficiently. And the other part is doing things that have never been done before. So looking at traditional things that are being done better, one of the biggest things is cloud computing. Now, you don't need cloud computing if you're sat at home all day, but imagine you're moving around a lot, as on a farm, and then imagine real-time weather monitoring, satellite data, work schedule updates from all your happy little farming team. Now link the cloud with small and cheap sensors that you stick on everything that moves. You're using 5G, the Internet of Things, on your farm to turn all your cows and sheep into components, each with sensors feeding back real-time data to the cloud, which the farmer can monitor with phone alerts. It's like the digital factory, but in the great outdoors. Now, at this point, I'm grateful to Paul Bennett for alerting me to a very useful article by a non-profit called grain.org. This is for generally for smallholders. This only came out yesterday, and it's on this very subject. It's much too big for me to summarise now, but I do recommend it. It works as a kind of passion killer, a sort of antidote to the optimism of the new scientist techies. So the contrast between tech optimism and worldly cynicism will be something of a theme as I proceed. Now, the headline-grabbing factoid that I quoted, tractors, modern ones have more computer code than the first space shuttle. That fact was told to us by the boss of John Deere Tractors. Sounds impressive, but that space shuttle first flew in 1982, and think how good computers were back then. This is picture 9. That guy doesn't seem to be steering that tractor, and he's got a kid in there as well. But maybe he doesn't need to steer it, because the boss of John Deere tells us that tractor technology is more advanced than the automotive industry, and it's got advanced telematics, and that is computerized autonomy with sensors, precision driving, GPS and path planning. It basically can drive itself. If it has sprayers, then the sprayers have smart nozzles with a thing called pulse width modulation on each nozzle to control individual flow rate. And the tractors automatically deflate their tire pressures in damp conditions so as not to compact the soil. Combines are also smart. I sat through a fascinating 20 minutes on how a combine works and all the different things it does, which I won't share with you. Well, now it does them all better. The UK's biggest crop is winter wheat, and modern combines can process 100 tonnes an hour. Somebody in the audience at this point asked, how are farmers supposed to afford all this? And a farmer in the audience responded, they borrow a lot of money. Moving on then, AI and robotics. The next picture is a drone swarm, a Pentagon drone swarm. Now, AI is good at spotting patterns in large data sets. When a pest or a disease invades a crop, it usually does it from the edges, but edge patterns are hard to spot until it's too late. So you deploy AI drone swarms to identify problems and AI treatment drones to treat them. Both of these swarms recharge at what's called their solar kennel. Now, weeds are impossible to get out with big machinery without crushing all the nearby plants, or without intense manual labour. Enter the solar or even the insect-eating microbot that patrols the crop rows at the centimetre level. Now, if you think that sounds unlikely, think about this. You want to know why farmers prefer monocropping to bicropping, even though we've known for thousands of years that bicropping is better because you get fewer weeds, fewer pests and higher productivity. Just look at the next slide, 11. The tiny little weed that you get with the bicrop and the massive weed that you get with the monocrop. Why don't they go for bicropping then? Basically because farmers say it's too complicated and they haven't got the time. Well, with AI automation, they probably could bicrop or even tricrop with no problems. Oh, and incidentally, there was an item in Today's New Scientist about tree planting robots that can plant a hectare of new forest in 6 hours and then weed the seedlings as well. Right, OK, so that's quite a lot of hardware porn there. Now for some new age laboratory stuff, which we can sum up as biotech. So partly this is about biotech is about immune systems, resistance genes. The Sainsbury lab invented the RNA interference process, if you're interested. The basic idea is it's better to boost resistance than to resort to pesticides and herbicides. They've been doing this a lot with farm animals and livestock. The idea is to reduce the use of antibiotics because antibiotics in livestock is probably what's caused the global MRSA crisis that we've all temporarily forgotten about. They do this with CRISPR gene editing. This is different from GM. GM is what's called transgenesis, where you introduce foreign genetic material. CRISPR gene editing is where you tweak what's already there. Now, again, this is brought up at the New Scientist event, and some scepticism from the audience members. Someone asked a philosophical question at this point. Should we be changing nature to suit present human behaviour, or should we be changing present human behaviour to suit nature? Well, there's a question for you. You can discuss afterwards. Okay, next picture 12. Cellular agriculture. This is food without fields, or lab-grown food, if you like, which the scientists are very keen to point out is no more unnatural than making beer or Marmite out of yeast. The best-known example of this is cultured meat. The focus is on minced or processed meat, like burgers and fish fingers and things, because it's pretty much impossible to replicate the structure of a real steak, or at least to do it economically. Here's a couple of graphs on cultured meat. The first one, picture 13, is the you can see that it's the lowest on resources for just about everything but energy. It's quite high on energy, not as high as beef or sheep or pork, but certainly higher than poultry. Everything else, it's vanishingly small. The next one, just to give you an idea, is the investment that's gone into cultured meat over the last few years, and you can see in 2020 it's skyrocketed. So there's a lot of money going into this. Next slide, 15, is the promissory narratives of cultured meat, what they're claiming it will do. The talk I went to on this said that you have to take some of these claims with a pinch of salt, because the problem is that all of this technology is proprietary, so nobody's got any idea what these firms are doing or what they're putting in these things. A Guardian article recently echoed the scepticism I mentioned earlier, that it suggested that cultured meat is an over-engineered solution, and why can't we just eat less meat instead? Well, okay, there's another discussion point. But meat's not the only thing they're culturing. They're also culturing egg protein, which is used in practically all the food industry, throughout the food industry and everything. The next picture is just a marketing company's, it's not real science, it's marketing company's idea of telling you, here's how it works. So you've got all your nutrients and inputs on one side. You've got this big gizmo in the middle called a bioreactor. And then it says food out of thin air. Well, it's not out of thin air at all, but that's what they're telling you. Okay, so in one experiment, they said that they were able to grow a half a kilo of protein in a week in a domestic kitchen unit. That's 4 quarter pounders. That's not bad going. Okay, so that's some of the tech. And now let's go on to the question of how well does the tech meet the challenges? Well, I would say on the whole, the techie solutions don't really address the fact that we're going about food production largely in the wrong way. We're monocropping on a vast scale with chemical inputs, creating soil erosion and deforesting to make way for animal feed and sugarcane. So the techie solutions are only really helping us to do it the wrong way, but more efficiently. They're not designed to produce more food, and I said earlier that we don't even need more food. There's already enough, there's already enough food in the world to feed everybody. It's just that they don't have the money. These solutions are about producing it more cheaply with more savings, which means more profits. And arguably, as I'm going to go on to show in a minute, for fewer and fewer producers. Because really we have to ask, who is going to use all this tech? As I already mentioned, not many farms can afford it. In the UK, there are 200,000 farms. Only 260 of these are using any of this new tech. Globally, the picture's even worse. The contribution of smallholders to global food production is estimated, a fuzzy figure, around about 70%, depends where you go for your source. Most of this is labour-intensive cash cropping. And they're like, these people's livelihoods are being made harder by climate change. Now, many of them are very poor. They don't have bank accounts, but a lot of them do have smartphones. And this offers big tech a way in. These small farmers are going to be offered all the benefits of big tech and data, including online banking services, seed supply, weather data, and crop advice, all via their smartphones. Now, this sounds great, and they will probably buy in because it will be more efficient, but then they'll be locked into these smart systems and unable to escape. This is an argument that Grain.org puts. They'll be contracted to buy expensive and sell cheap, so they won't be able to compete with the big players. And the fear is that they're going to be swallowed up by these big players. So we could be looking at a replay of the enclosures or the highland clearances, but on a global scale. So who are the big corporate players in agriculture? Well, you might be surprised to know that you've heard of all of them. And here they are in picture 17. Google, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Alibaba, Facebook. Hard to believe, but these are the new big ag players. Now, Grain.org argues with justification, I think, that this is nothing less than the corporate capture of the food system. Not surprisingly, a lot of farmers aren't happy about this, and a lot of, certainly in the UK, as I learned in November, are refusing to share data. They argue that why should we give big corporations our data for free and then have them sell it back to us with unaffordable software and tools? It's not a quid pro quo. The farmers hate it, but chances are they won't be able to stop it. Now, moving on to a question that I can't resist addressing. How might food production be managed in socialism? Well, there's an awful lot I could say about this, about migrations, taking the people to the food rather than the food to the people, or turning the Sahara into a solar farm. But I want to speculate very briefly about just one thing, field systems. I want you to consider the following double proposition, that vegetable protein per acre far exceeds meat protein, and that small holdings per acre can produce more than large area farms. Now, as an indicator of this, although I know that price does not necessarily reflect use value, I refer to a 2019 Quebec study quoted in Farmers Weekly, which claims that the average large-scale corn or soybean farm produces $400 to $600 per acre, while micro farms can make up to $100,000 per acre. Now, what I'm suggesting here, and it is only a suggestion, is that in socialism, small might be smarter. Now, just take a look at these pictures. Picture 18. Have a look at that. Blow that one up. This is a Neolithic site. It's from 3,000 years old in Ireland. And you'll notice the squares on it. Now, they used to farm in squares in Neolithic times because they only had light wooden ploughs. So they had to plough it in a crosshatch way to break up the earth enough. You look at the terrain, it's quite hilly. Big combines couldn't work land like that. So today, hilly land like this is classed as unworkable. And so it's pastured out for animals instead. In fact, this is the biggest justification for the meat industry, that so much land is unworkable. Except it isn't. The ancient Celts worked it. Now look at the next picture and look what happens when heavy iron ploughs were invented. They were brought in to this country by the Vikings, probably. Now, heavy iron ploughs are very hard, they're very effective, but they're very hard to turn. So squares gave way to long strips, as you can see here. This is a modern, legacy, medieval landscape. Now, this is called strip farming or ribbon farming. Again, it's quite an uneven landscape, as you can see, but see how the furrows follow the contours of the land. Incidentally, a furrow length became known as a furlong, Garrett Harding of who coined the phrase "tragedy of the commons," argues that peasants needed to cooperate by pooling their oxen to make ploughing effective, and he called this the I quote logical equivalent of socialism. Now, this is strip farming or strip cropping. An acre, by the way, is the area of a strip that an ox can plough in one day. Now, if you look at the last picture here, I recommend you do open this up, otherwise you won't be able to see it. Look at the layout of this medieval manor. Now, what you'll notice is that the strips are kaleidoscopically arranged, really higgledy-piggledy, instead of being neat and symmetrical. Why are they like that? To work round the contours of the land. There's probably some terracing involved in there somewhere as well. Now, what's obvious is that this is quite a rigid setup, unsuited to major expansion, much more suited to a stable or steady state economy. And it's also quite labour intensive. Capitalist big agriculture can't cope with this system. Much cheaper, much less labour intensive to have huge open fields and monocropping and machinery and pasture animals where you can't do that. Hence the enclosures, hence the highland clearances, hence the destruction of thousands of years of strip cropping through over 5,000 Acts of Parliament in the UK by 1850. But remember what I said about the productivity of small over large. In socialism, instead of big mechanisation, would we see a return to the old ways, even though it's more labour intensive? Well, we're going to have a lot more time on our hands, and personally, I can imagine taking part in agriculture as quite a therapeutic exercise. Okay, so in conclusion then, speaking as a tech junkie, I think the future of food production technology is inventive, it's ingenious, it's exciting. But not just because it's a lot of shiny new toys. The big picture is that capitalism is bequeathing us an enormous legacy of tools that could maintain and largely automate the process of perpetual and sustainable material abundance, or at least sufficiency, which is the thing necessary for socialism to exist. That's speaking as a tech junkie. Speaking as a socialist, I have to say I sadly agree with grain.org and say that none of these developments are ultimately in the best interest of human well-being, and certainly not of individual farmers, but are conceived and designed and executed in the interest of market advantage and profit. Big tech is conquering the world through platform companies, which, along with big data, cloud computing and fintech, which is financial tech, are folding together into probably what will end up as four or five global players that run everything. The end game is for these few players to control global food production from the field to the plate, along with practically every aspect of our lives. Basically, it's world domination. But really, what do people expect? Capitalism has this drive built into it. If Amazon doesn't get us by the throat, Google will. If Google doesn't, Apple will. Unlike grain.org, I don't see any realistic prospect of the world's small farmers fighting some kind of Luddite rearguard action against the juggernaut of big agri-tech, because they're really facing the juggernaut of capitalism. And the only thing that can beat that is the vastly bigger juggernaut of the world's conscious working class. The best prospect for future food production isn't yet more technology, it's a socialist revolution to put the earth finally under new democratic management. Okay, that's it.
Thank you. Excellent talk, Paddy. Very well organised. I wasn't aware of how bad it was for the farmers, because there's not much they can do to avoid the big tech taking over. But it's catastrophic for the world life forms as well as the humans. And when we get socialism, if we ever do, we're going to have a hell of a lot of undoing of all the damage they're going to be doing. I'm glad, one personal note, I'm glad I eat organic. That's all.
Okay, thanks for that, Mike. Okay. Do you want to say something again, Paddy, in response to that?
No, is it that, I did have to leave a lot out. And I think species extinction, I think, is one of the most terrible indictments of capitalism going. We've discussed it before in other talks. But, yeah, you know, I agree.
Yeah. Okay, next, Jordan, all the way from America. Jordan, you wanting to speak, or are you just the point
still
was
muted.
Agreed?
He's still locked.
Okay, right. Okay. Well, I can't tell that. So if you can unmute, please, Jordan, and then try again, pal.
I wasn't trying to speak. My bad. I was just saying it was a great talk.
Cool. Good. Nicely acknowledged. So, Moggy, go on. What would you like to say?
Hello. Yes, thank you for a very interesting talk. Unfortunately, I kept missing bits of it because my connection has been terrible this morning. It's been clicking on and off, but I think I got most of it. I'm all in favour of this. The way the medieval manor is set out, because we've had quite a bit about this in New Zealand, that if you've got whole areas that are just doing one crop or one thing, it's not having a very good effect on the insects. And you need insects for pollination. If you don't want to have to use all these chemicals and things. And so by planting out like that, you can do what is called companion planting, where you plant a row of something and then a row of something else that will deter the insects that are going to destroy the main crop. And they teach this at Lincoln University in the South Island, where they've got a course on organic husbandry. But also it's very important that if you've got one of these farms where you're growing all sorts of things, it's very important that you also have a few beehives. And by cultivating bees, they will do all the pollinating for you and so on. So I think there's a great benefit of going back to this this type of farming, where you're growing a lot of different crops and encouraging a lot of different insects, which means you can cut out all the chemicals that people are using, which are obviously not doing much good for the nutrients of the food, but they're also killing off all the insects.
Excellent contribution, Moggy. Yeah, well said.
Yeah,
nothing from you, Paddy.
Yeah, if you missed any of it, Moggy, don't worry, it's on SPGB catch up, or soon will be. Your companion planting, that's nowadays it also goes by the name of bicropping, as I mentioned bicropping, and tricropping as well. When I helped out on an allotment one time, I learned all sorts of amazing country lore about bicropping and tricropping, which I've forgotten all of it again. Something about planting rhubarb next to potatoes or something keeps the pests off the potatoes, and that sort of thing. Fascinating.
Question from Brian.
Yes, just to point out that it's just not food crops, right, that's coming under the hammer. There's also drug crops, particularly marijuana. I watched a film last night on Netflix, and it made great emphasis on the fact Northern California, particularly in Humboldt County, which is known as the Golden Triangle for medicinal marijuana production. They've legalized it now over there, right? But the consequences of it is that it's heavy taxation on the product and also heavy regulation, right? And subsequently the cost of production has gone up and profitability has gone down, right? I can that this is also going to happen in the new agriculture introduction has come along. You're going to have further regulation, right? And profitability is going to drop, right? And you'll just take it from there, you know? Like your views on that, Paddy.
Go on, Paddy.
Yeah, probably. I don't disagree. I think the small farmers are going to find it increasingly difficult to compete. Incidentally, you've just made me think that my last couple of years' attempts of greenhouse crops of cucumbers, courgettes and tomatoes had no luck at all. But you've just given me an idea about marijuana. So maybe that'll be next year's idea.
Doogie McClellan next.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, I enjoyed your talk, buddy. One thing I wanted to know about is soil erosion as well. And also, why do they keep having to cut down more and more forests and things in places like Brazil to plant these palm oil crops or whatever, or for cattle food or whatever? Is it because of soil erosion? What you could say on that, really?
It's mainly, I think, the expanding meat industry. They're deforesting to plant soya, and 80% of the global soya crop goes to animal and fish food. It's amazing that farmed fish are fed 50% soya in their diet, which I discovered. So I think that's what's mainly driving it. There are other reasons for deforestation as well, but none of them anywhere near as impactful as this. Weirdly, though, whenever there's a global recession, deforestation goes into just stops, as does oil drilling and things like that for financial reasons. And then when a boom starts, the deforestation starts. So you can see it sort of pulsing like a breathing, like a living thing.
Okay, thanks, Paddy.
Other comment in there from Jordan. Are you wanting to add on that, Jordan, or is that just a statement you're making? Emerald Triangle.
Yeah. My bad, bro. No.
Yeah,
I
call it the Golden Triangle.
Okay, cool. So, Howard, go on, mate. You're next. Can't hear you, Howard. Need to unmute, mate.
Very sorry. Paddy. Very interested indeed. But in respect to the comment you made in response to Dougie's point about how soya and various other crops are grown to feed animals to produce meat, it's ironic, really, isn't it, that meat consumption in the developed capitalist world, apart from chicken, is actually down. It's sort of coming down gradually for various reasons. And the reason why the need for meat, the perceived need for meat is growing, is that other parts of the world are sort of becoming more developed. And when that happens, what people want is meat. So on the one hand, we should be pleased to see that increasing numbers of people are getting sort of at least slightly higher standards of living. But the trouble is that's reflected in more and more animals being killed and more environmental damage. You just can't win in capitalism, can you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, things do change in capitalism. Like, behaviours have changed. I mean, you only have to think about smoking. You know, it's not just this country. It's right around the world where attitudes have changed in a very short time. And, you know, I wonder if there are signs that attitudes are changing in perhaps the more advanced capitalist countries on things like meat, certainly on sugar, fats, that kind of thing. Sainsbury's has been predicting that 25% of us will be vegan by 2025, which I find a bit hard to believe. It's only 4 years away. This January, a record number of people around the world did the Veganuary. That's 500,000 people. But when you remember that's only 1/14,000th of the global population, that still doesn't seem hugely significant. But one of the scientists at the New Scientist Day said, just frankly said, if the whole world wants to eat meat, it's going to be a disaster. You know, and there's been a lot of talk about eating insects and this sort of thing, which I think Libcom got very upset about this idea. They called this, they sort of politicised this. They said this is about enacting a drastic reduction in living standards for the plebs, which will force them to put bugs, weeds and sewage on the menu while the Davos elites continue to feast on the finest cuisine in their ivory towers. Lovely little quote there. I've got more than a little bit of sympathy for that as well. But, you know, I think maybe attitudes are changing amongst young people anyway.
Can I just come back on that a second?
Yeah, of course, go on.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's what I was saying. Yeah, attitudes certainly are changing in the advanced world and what you might call the advanced world anyway, the capitalist West, and people are eating less meat. There's no chance at all that 25% of the population will be vegan by 2025. Forget about that. It's going up gradually, but only gradually. But attitudes aren't changing that much, as I understand it, in developing parts of the world, places like China, where they actually want more and more meat. And I don't think they're smoking any less there either, to be honest. So there is a sort of, the clear distinction at the moment. And you know, I suppose if you look at the way the West was 40, 50 years ago, then you're probably looking at the same kind of thing, that's the same kind of process that's being gone through in places like China, even like Russia for that matter now. So these things will, I think, sort of take longer than we think to actually evolve.
I agree with you. I do think there's one thing significant about the fact that it's Sainsbury's making this prediction, and also it's not just Sainsbury's, it's also Tesco. When they say 25% of us will be vegan by 2025, I think what they're saying is we're going to make you be vegan by 2025 because there's good money in it for us, because vegan products in supermarkets are way more expensive than their meat counterparts, and it's all processed crap anyway. It's all pre-cooked stuff that you cook in you stick in the microwave or the oven. So they're expecting to make a fortune out of this. So I think that they're going to get behind it and push it for money.
Certainly, a hell of a job persuading me to go vegan or vegetarian, but that's just me. Moggy, you're next.
Right, thank you. Yes, this thing about producing more meat, I think it. Here in New Zealand, I think people are eating less meat, but over the last 25 years, we've been producing more meat. In other words, dairy farms have increased and increased for the export market because there's money to be made. But the problem is it's causing a lot of problems now because cows do a lot of poo. This is ending up getting into the rivers, it's polluting the waterways. We used to always have a reputation for nice, clean rivers in New Zealand. Now we don't, because they're getting polluted with cow poo. Also, cows produce a lot of methane gas, which we're apparently right under the hole in the ozone layer, and the methane is it's increasing the problem of the hole in the ozone. So about 20 years ago, the government at the time decided they would put what they called a fart tax on farmers for how many head of cattle they how many head of cows they got. Because of this problem. But I can't see this problem going down. While we're making money out of exporting meat, I don't think the dairy farms are going to get any less, not at this stage anyway.
There's an interesting parallel there that with whale meat, in fact, whale hunting. There's only about three countries in the world, maybe four, that still do whale hunting, despite there being a global moratorium on it. And what's really strange is that it was Norway, Iceland and Japan, I think. But what's really strange is they insist on their right to do whale hunting, and yet hardly anybody in any of those countries actually wants to eat whale meat. And one of the main reasons is whale meat is pretty horrible. If you're used to sort of beef or pork or, you know, one of the more domestic types of meat, whale meat is really tough and doesn't taste very good. So their domestic markets are collapsing, and you know, they're carrying on doing it. And why are they doing it? Because they're selling it to tourists, because everybody who goes to Iceland thinks that they ought to have whale meat. So it's a bit of a parallel to what you were saying, Moggy. And incidentally, your fart tax in New Zealand reminds me that in Denmark they've got a pesticide tax, which is an interesting experiment.
Okay, all right, Steve, you got a question now from Red. Gonna have to try again, Steve. There's some sort of change going on with your microphone.
Yeah, your connection's buggered, Steve.
Good there, Steve. Are you want to try again? Right? Maybe come back to you, Steve, while you're sorting that out, Freddie.
Yeah, Paddy, that's very interesting and informative, and many of the comments that comrades have made, I think we can obviously see where the problems are, and this, the solutions to them. I think, in part, you allude to it, and that as society, as we become more aware of what's happening around us globally, some of the cause through the farming methods currently used. I think I mentioned the other night there on for some other reason in the discussion that localized, certainly where I live, localized allotments are becoming more and more popular. And I think that in part, it's obviously financial reasons, people can grow their own food, and it's certainly much more tastier just going straight to your allotment and getting your potatoes or your tomatoes or whatever it might be. Do you see this evolving to an even greater extent, though, as we become more aware and as socialists, we see the advantages in more localised production on a communal basis throughout the various cities and towns, etc. Thank you.
I think it could do. I certainly think it could do. I mean, as you say, allotments have become very popular in recent years, and homegrown stuff does taste better by and large, I think. Although in terms of finances, if you factored in a sort of a minimum wage for yourself for the hours you put in on an allotment, I think you'd find that the cost of your homegrown vegetables was 4 or 5 times what it would be in a supermarket. That's what I found when I worked on an allotment. Anyway, it was just, I would have worked it out, and I just thought, well, it's not financially viable. It's something that you do if you really enjoy it. Sadly, I have to admit that I didn't enjoy it enough to carry on with it. Is it going to evolve in the future? I think that depends where you live, to be honest. I think it depends on the climate, on the soil, the amount of light you can get. Where I live, I just have a backyard with very high walls around it and other houses, and it just doesn't get very much light. So even though I've got a little greenhouse in it, I just can't get anything to grow in it because it's just not enough light through the day. can't, you know, and the sort of things that you could do, like heated greenhouses, well, they're just not affordable, or they're not, you know, they're not financially viable either. So I think it really depends. But I do know of people in my area who are doing things like forest gardening, and they say that this is quite sustainable year round and has good output. So I think community gardening, you know, this sort of guerrilla gardening that's been going on for a few years, I think that's got some potential. I think the idea of people sort of taking control of their own sort of food production to some extent in the community, I like that idea. I don't do it myself, but I do like the idea of people doing that. But it's not going to deal with the larger question of capitalism, obviously. But I certainly think that if people are more, you know, sort of get a bit closer to the sort of process of food production, like I've tried and not very successfully, you know, but I've tried, you know, I think it sort of connects you to the whole question of food production. It doesn't just, you know, it's no longer just stuff that you buy plastic wrapped in a supermarket to shove down your face without thinking about. I think it's quite important to be connected to the process in some way.
I'm going to go back. Try again, Steve. Are you there? Want to try again?
Yeah. Is this any better?
Yeah, that's fine.
Perfect.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to just go back a bit to what Moggy was saying about the intensive animal farming and this bad effect in New Zealand, which is, and this of course is going on all over the world. There are, I've seen examples in France of a place in Brittany where they've got a lot of pork production, and it's also just happened in Uruguay on a river called Santa Lucia, which is one of which is the main source of potable water for Montevideo. And what's occurring there is they're getting algal bloom and all sorts of stuff because of the nitrogen content of the water, which is a runoff from these intensive farms. So yeah, I mean that's going on in various places around the world. But I just wanted to come back and put something to Howard, because I think he said earlier on that meat production, meat eating in UK is declining. But except as far as chicken's concerned, and chicken is going up, and I think there's something that we could tie into what Libcon was talking about with the good enough for the workers, because the reason that chicken is increasingly consumed in this country is because its price has dropped enormously, and its price has dropped enormously because chickens are raised to slaughter at 40 days, whereas it used to take 80 to 90 days to grow a chicken, which is why when a lot of us were kids, our mothers could, and our parents could only afford a chicken like once every 6 weeks if you were lucky, and it was viewed as a luxury. These days, it's absolutely horrible pap that's no flavour. Don't want to offend any vegetarians, but it's no flavour at all. And it's the rubbish that we are able to afford as part of our, as part of our lives. And it's the case that obviously that is the market that's forced that on producers, and it forces it on us. You could take the same thing. When was the last time anybody had a really nice tomato? Right. If you live in UK and you can't afford organic, which most of us can't, then it'll be a long time since I've just give over bothering with them. But the issue is, I mean, fair play to Mike Brown for going for organic. Unfortunately, for the majority of us, we don't have that choice, because when you look at the premium for organic food, it just becomes out of our reach. And just one other slight thing, just an observation. I was in South America on one of these big cattle ranch,
And what they were talking about there is introducing a system. Argentinian beef is sold all over the world at a premium. And what's being introduced there now is the feedlot system, which they've got in the United States. Rather than being grass-fed, they're being fed on forage. And this is a far more intensive system. And, of course, I was talking to the owner. They weren't going to eat it. They would sell it, and they realized that the quality is not really fit for the likes of them. But for the likes of us, it's okay. So, yeah, just one of the real effects that the capitalist market has on our lives. Okay, thanks.
Fair points, Steve. All classic capitalist mentality over, quantity over quality. Yeah, do you want to come back to that, Paddy?
I agree with that, everything Steve said. I mean, the market has forced mass production on consumers, but then I don't know if you think about the sort of modern production is more sort of artisanal. You know, you've got the sort of craft fairs, craft beers, these sort of things, and these are all still controlled by the big corporations, obviously. I wouldn't necessarily rule out the idea of vegetables tasting nice again. You'll just have to pay more for them. But just on one other point you mentioned about nitrogen runoff, one of the problems with monocropping is that they're still using nitrogen fertilizers produced by something called the Haber-Bosch process that was invented in the 1900s and used for gas weapons during the First World War. They do it because it's easy and it's cheap. But there are other ways to fix nitrogen using cover crops like red clover. You sow red clover in the autumn and it's a cover crop for the winter and it fixes the nitrogen. But farmers won't use it. And the reason they won't use it is they can't make cash out of a cover crop because it's a cover crop. You dig it in when you've done with it and then plant a cash crop. But so farmers won't bother with it, even though they know that it's better for the soil. I know this from the New Scientist thing. This is what farmers said.
Can I just come back, comrade? On that particular issue, Paddy, I've got experience of that myself because I was trying to do exactly that by planting a cover crop on some land that I had. And it ended up that basically what I was growing is a cover crop which was used for winter forage. And but unfortunately, by the time you get to it, by the time you've done that, because you're operating in a market, the price that I could get for this cover crop was less than it cost me to get to produce it. So this is where that worked against. The market worked against that type of the type of thing that you're talking about. Yeah, farmers these days have got to get two crops in a year. They can't just leave it apparently being idle, which and we know it's ridiculous what they're doing.
Yeah, and it's the same with monocropping. It's much easier to harvest a monocrop. I mean, think about it than a bicrop. You know, it's just really fiddly to harvest a bicrop. You have to do them at different times. They need different treatments, different feeds, all this sort of thing. So, yeah, farmers just can't realistically do this. They've got sort of financial deadlines to meet.